Yeah, well, this is a very, this is one of the awkward rabbinical exercises. Obviously, the rabbis don't want to look at a woman not naked. On the other hand, the rabbis do have to see that she's under the water. So the way this works, practically different, but they didn't do it different ways. It's just a question of working it out. Some have a woman go into the mikveh draped in a white, big white sheet, like a bed sheet or a very big white towel, totally covered. And she faces the wall, let's say away from, the rabbis are facing the back. And they don't go into the room, or they stand with their head turned away until the mikveh lady tells us she is under. When she is under, we turn, and when we see that everything is underwater, but all you see is kind of a towel. In other words, the woman is under a towel, and there's nothing above the water, so that is considered to be seeing her under the water. So that's what you do. So basically, we don't see her go under the water. We see that she is under the water, but we actually don't see her.
And that's the reason the rabbis never see her face in their lives?
No, no. So the answer is we have to see her. In other words, the basic idea is before she goes to the mikveh, we see her. And we actually see her in the mikveh draped in a towel. Well, she's in the, imagine somebody in the water draped in a towel. So we see her head. We then turn away. Mikveh lady tells us we can look now. We look now, and we all we see is like a white sheet floating underwater. So we don't assume there's a hidden exit somewhere that she sneaked out. So consequently, we saw her in the mikveh a second ago, and we see nothing on top of the water surface now. So that's considered halachically seeing her under the water. That's how we arrange it. Yeah. So that's the best we can do, we do have to see that she is under the. We have to see that she's in the mikveh, and we have to see that she's under the water, but we don't see the intermediate stages. Yeah.
I know there's a Mishnah in saying that certain weapons and whatnot that Jews can't sell to the non-Jews.
Yeah.
I was wondering, their Israeli defense contracting firms do business with.
Yes, it's a very good question. There are tshuvas written about it. The Mishnah says in Maseches Avodah Zarah that there are certain things we are not allowed to sell idol worshippers or pagans, and that is, we're not allowed to sell them weapons because the fear would be they would go ahead and use them against Jews, and therefore we're not allowed to sell them. Now, as you know, you may know, the state of Israel is actually a very, very large arms merchant. In fact, this has been some political criticism. For example, when South Africa had the apartheid regime, Israel was actually the main supplier of weapons to South Africa, some of which were used against their own population. So there's been a lot of controversy with Israel. But some people have raised the halakhic issue, which is not that the state of Israel would care necessarily, but they raised the halakhic issue that you're not allowed to sell weapons of destruction to non-Jews. So there are different answers. Some say Eino Chinami, it's Osir, but the state of Israel is not making a halachic decision. Others say that, again, there's a big difference between idolaters and non-Jewish. In other words, you have to be very careful that when we prohibit things to idolaters, we are referring to pagans, and we are not referring to what you might call monotheistic people, who would normally have some semblance of morality. Now, that's the famous writings of the Meiri, who claim that all of the halachos against Ovdei Avodah Zarah do not apply to Christians or Muslims. Now, the truth of the matter is, in this world, to talk about monotheists as having a higher sense of morality when we're dealing with 1 billion Muslims who do not really have a sense of morality is very difficult, but this is what the Meiri says. Others say that there's a difference between selling to individuals and selling to nations. Because when I sell it to an individual, so individuals use weapons in this country, right? So I can't sell weapons to people, to non-Jews in this country, because there's a real fear they'll use it against me. But when I sell weapons to other countries with whom I'm not in a state of war, I don't have to be choshesh that South Africa, and again, obviously Israel is not going to sell weapons to Arab countries. that would be crazy. So when you're selling weapons to nations that are allies, you're not mechuyev to be choshesh, they're going to use it against the Jewish people. So there'd be different justifications for that. Yeah.
The difference between defensive weapons versus offensive weapons?
Well, a weapon that can only be used defensively, like an Iron Dome system, is always permitted. That was never prohibited. The prohibition is only for weapons that can be eventually used against the Jews. Yeah. But we wouldn't call, technically, we would not call a defensive weapon a weapon, really. It's just a defense against weapons. Yeah. Part of it is, I spoke about this, part of it is the idea that although Pinchas sanctified God's name by an act of violence, it still was an act of violence, and there's a certain shame and chisar, thank you, there's a certain shame and chisara in sanctifying Hashem through violence. That is why the word shalom, Hashem gave Pinchas a covenant of shalom, so the vav of shalom is a split vav. If you look in the Sefer Torah, even in the Chumash, it's called a vav katia, a split vav, and the Sefer Torah has to have the vav written that way, and part of that is a remez, that whatever peace you get through milchama is not going to be a complete peace. There'll always be a certain pagam in it. So on one hand, Pinchas was zeicha to the kahuna. Remember this, Pinchas was not officially a kohen till after he killed Zimri. How could I say that? Pinchas was born from a kohen, born from a lezer? The answer is no. The only time you're automatically a kohen is if you're born from a kohen. But since Pinchas was born from Elazar before Elazar was anointed as a Kohen, so Pinchas was born as a non-Kohen, and he needed to be anointed separately, meaning any children in existence at the time of the original anointment were not automatically Kohanim. They had to be anointed. Pinchas was not anointed as a Kohen until after he killed Zimri. Now the Mefarshim say, well, why was that so? Why wasn't Pinchas anointed first? The answer is Hashem knew Pinchas would kill somebody. There actually is a halacha that when a Kohen kills somebody, even accidentally, he can no longer serve as a Kohen. Can't even duchen, actually. Big, big shailus that Shulchan Aruch says, if a Kohen kills somebody accidentally, he does not duchen. And there's a whole shaila. What if you have a Kohen in the army who's actually doing a mitzvah? Some say even then he cannot duchen. So you
and
see...
Huh?
He is a Kohen and his children are Kohanim, but he cannot... Duchen, just like David HaMelech could not build the Beis HaMikdash because he was a man of blood. So what do you see from all of this? What you see from all of this is that there is a pagam and a chisaron in being a shofech dam even when it's a mitzvah. And that's why Hashem had to have Pinchas do it before he became a Kohen, so he shouldn't be disqualified. So because of that reason in and of itself, Pinchas kind of becomes a bit more anonymous, but not totally. In Tanakh, in a number of places, when it refers to a Kohen, although it doesn't say which Kohen, we say it is Pinchas. And of course, you know that Chazal teach us that Pinchas lived, never died, actually. And Pinchas eventually became the Navi Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas. So Pinchas is going to be the announcer of Mashiach. So in many ways, he didn't die, but he had kind of acquired new identities over the year. Yeah.
Is the Venus flytrap kosher place to eat?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, people often say that the sign of a kosher animal is that it's not a carnivore. Right? In fact, you know, this is a common explanation that even Rishonim give, that kosher animals that chew their cud are all plant eaters, herbivorous animals, because Hashem does not want us to acquire the midah of cruelty. And if we were to eat an animal of prey, that would give us a cruelty. So the question that's being raised is an interesting question. Well, what about a plant that eats animals or eats life, such as the Venus flytrapper or the like? Well, you have a very good point. Lemaisa, it is kosher because we don't find any plant that's considered to be treif, except for, well, there are some plants you're not allowed to eat, obviously, plants of kalayim. If you plant grain and grapes together, the Torah says the resulting growth is forbidden, and of course, orla, the fruit that grows on a tree in the first 3 years of its planting, is usher. So there is a concept, of course, that plants can be forbidden, but you don't find the carnivorous condemnation being extended to plant life. Yeah.
Is
wondering, Dr. Thomas, if somebody, Pastor Todd, had a gender change surgery, does that change, my halakhic obligation towards them? For example, if a man became a woman and I landed up in the same room as him/her, would I be over yichud?
Yeah, this is Baruch Hashem, this is not a common shaila, but this is a very, very difficult shaila. You know, there is a certain percentage of people that undergo what is called a sex change or sex reassignment surgery. In fact, even in YU, there's a whole situation, because YU is supposed to be a religious school, and one of the college teachers, one of the English teachers, was a man who surgically changed to a woman, and some of the more religious students at YU were saying, how can a religious school allow this, etc., whatever it would be. And that's the perennial problem YU always has, because on one hand, it's also a secular college, and they have to obey non-discrimination laws. That's YU's perpetual dilemma. So let me just point out the following. We have to differentiate two situations. We have to differentiate a genuine sex change, where a person was a man and became a woman, versus things like androgynous, where a person has both signs, and then let's take one at a time. According to most poskim, this is a pretty amazing thing, most poskim do not recognize a sex change as valid whatsoever, meaning to say, a man who changes physically into a woman, or vice versa, is still a man or still a woman. Meaning to say, essentially, they engaged in castration or mutilation or whatever it would be. Now, that's a very amazing thing. That would technically mean that this person who now looks like a woman technically could still marry a woman or whatever. In other words, the person's status has not changed at all. Okay? It might very well be, halakhically, well, I'll tell you one thing. Halakhically, it might be that a man who changed into a woman would not be allowed to marry, because he would be the same as a castrated person. There is a law in the Torah that way. But putting that aside, he would have to put on tefillin. I mean, not that the person who did this would be asking the question, but technically. Right? So according to most people, he does not change at all. That would even mean, bizarrely enough, that... in other words, the guy was a man who became a woman. I would not have an Isra Yichud with him. Meaning I could be in the room with this thing that looks like a woman because he's halakhically a man. There is no Isra of Yichud. So that's a pretty extreme position, but most poskim say the Torah does not recognize the ability to change your gender. Now, where things are tricky, though, it is relatively rare. I mean, the whole thing is rare, but this is more rare for a clearly assigned gender to change to another gender. The way what normally happens is when you have hermaphrodite, which the Gemara talks about a lot, it's called an androgynous. An androgynous is a person that is born with both markers. There are, at least in partially developed form, both male and female. Now, by androgynous, the Gemara never discusses changing it, but the Gemara discusses what's the status of an androgynous. Do I treat him as a suffix man, suffix woman, or is it a new creature, kind of a third gender? There are many, many halachas about androgynous. But here, the one thing the poskim have said is that halacha might permit changing a person whose gender is indeterminate into something definite. And usually, the way I understand gender reassignment, in fact, one of the big gender reassignment things is Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, near where I used to live, is that surgeons prefer to make people girls for the very simple reason that it's easier. It's easier to remove than to add, meaning to say, if someone is hermaphrodite, so there's already a womb, but there's the male organ, so you just remove it, etc. And be it as it may, whatever the surgery would be, halacha would differentiate between going from man to woman or woman to man, which is not recognized, versus assigning a definitive status when a person's status is indeterminate. But it's a very, very difficult child. And once again, I mean, for the small percentage of kids that are involved in this, it's a very, very tragic and difficult situation. There are many suicides of children in this situation, so it's a big, big rachmanis. Yeah. Yeah. This is quite amazing, and you know, Aguna is a subject I have a book on Aguna, which I wrote many years ago, and this is pretty amazing, and I've been looking for the decision of the Beis Din. Aguna, of course, is the problem that we've had for hundreds of years of a man who refuses to divorce his wife. Now, what can you do? In secular law, a woman could file for divorce and just get a divorce, but in halacha, the man has to give a get. Now, the truth of the matter is, the problem of aguna is a bigger problem in the United States than it is in Eretz Yisrael. The reason is very simple. A woman can go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din can order a man to give a get. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, once a Beis Din orders a man to give a get, halacha permits beating a person till he says, I'll give a get. Halacha permits that once there's a psak Beis Din. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, although the secular law does not permit beating, but the secular law does have all sorts of compulsions, a man can go to jail in Israel for not giving a get. But again, that's not a panacea. That's not a magic cure either, because there are people who stay in jail for 20 years before they give a get. And there are people already in jail who refuse to give a get. So what do you do? Halacha would permit beating them until they give a get, but secular law does not permit beating them. In Israel, you could the government will take away a person's passport, suspend their driver's license. So in Israel, because of the integration of halacha into the secular law, there are many pressures that can be put on a person. In America, there are virtually no pressures, because let's say I'm in America, a Beis Din tells me to give a get. What if I say no? What happens? So the Beis Din could excommunicate me, but I say, what? If I'm not firm, or I'll go to another shul, a lot of people don't listen to cherubs. So I would have to say the aguna problem is more serious in America than in Israel, because in Israel the law itself gives a lot of ways of helping. But even in Israel, it doesn't always work. There are agunas, because some men are willing to stay in jail. The Beis Din hasn't issued an order for various reasons. Not every woman gets an order, etc. So there was a Beis Din in Tzfat that was dealing with a case of aguna. And they came up with the following idea, which is really almost an unparalleled idea. And this is a chashuv of the Beis Din. The Beis Din basically said the following. Since it is a zechus for a man, it's a benefit for a man, not to be married to a woman he doesn't want to be married to. Because he really doesn't want to be married to her. So we can be his shaliach without his permission, based on the principle of zachin li adam shelo b'fanav. Now, in the case of Tzfat, there was something even worse. Let me go back a little bit. In the case of Tzfat, the guy was in a coma, was that right? Okay, so let me change that a little bit. So one case of aguna is husband doesn't want to give again. But in the case of Tzfat, we have another complication that Israeli law could not help. That is, the husband was unconscious. The husband was in a coma. Now, what's the problem with the husband in the coma? Only a husband can give a get. Only a husband can make a shaliach to give a get. Right? Now, if I'm unconscious, I didn't make a shaliach. So who can give a get to my wife? Here, no Beis Din is going to help you. A Beis Din can order a guy who's conscious, give a get or we'll throw you in jail. Give a get or we'll beat you up. But how do you give a get if the husband's unconscious? Not only that, we paskin, even if the husband had made a shaliach before he got unconscious, and then he got unconscious, the shalichus is batal. But, okay, that's a machlokas, is it derais or derabanan? But it's a double pashut. If he's unconscious, he can't make a shaliach. So l'chayra, there is literally no way the woman could get divorced in the case of unconscious husband. So this is what the Beis Din of Tzfat said. This is their chiddush. They said that since no unconscious man would want, if you could ask the person miraculously, do you want your wife to be married to you if you're going to be in a coma the rest of your life? He would certainly say no. So it is a zechus to divorce his wife because that's what he truly would have wanted. Now, what is the rule of zachin li'adam shelo b'fanav? I can confer a benefit on a person without his knowledge because I assume he vadai would have agreed had he been able to consent. So based on this, the basin of Tzfat in a 90-page psak, 90 pages, paskins that the basin can appoint a shaliach for the husband, although the husband is unconscious, based on zochin the adam shelo b'fanav. Now, this is an absolutely amazing ruling, and I believe it's been condemned by Gedolei HaPoskim in Yerushalayim, because the one thing is that the only time I say zochin li'adam shelo b'fanav is for a person who could make a shaliach, meaning if I could make a shaliach, but I'm in China or I'm incommunicado, so perhaps we can make a shaliach if that's what I really want. But since a person that is incompetent, a shote, cannot make a shaliach, we can't work through the principle of zochin li'adam shelo b'fanav. Are you guys familiar? Have you come across the principle? Zochin li'adam shelo b'fanav, meaning anything that's a benefit or a zechus, I can be your agent even without your consent. Right? So they applied this to the unconscious husband.
Is it based on Rov?
Well, ultimately it's based on Rov.
Because we know that maybe he is the one who doesn't want
Yeah, you're right. Since we don't know for sure, we have to base it on Rov. Most people would not want their wives to be tied down. So I'm very, very eager to get the tshuva to see exactly because this is pretty unparalleled. In fact, typically, I would say the unconscious husband is one of the real unsoluble problems in halakha. We really didn't have a way out of this. The Beis Nef Tzfat is offering us a way, but we don't know if halakhically it's acceptable. Yeah. Yeah, so it is befeirish that you're not allowed to own a pig farm. That's a Gemara in Bava Kamma. The Lashon is, well, the Lashon actually is you cannot raise pigs. That's the Lashon. So owning a pig farm, presumably you would be the one that's raising the pigs. Working on the farm may not be usher. It may be usher to own the pigs. But still, you're obviously engaged in an activity that Chazal thought very poorly of. And it's interesting, you know, why? Like, what's so bad about the pig? You know, it's interesting for, you know, the pig is the universal symbol of treif, right? Even somebody, you know, even people who don't keep kosher, you know, there's some revulsion against pig. Now, why is pig worse, let's say, than nevela? You know, if you have a McDonald's hamburger, it's hamburger, but it's treif, you know. It doesn't have the same revulsion. So it's interesting that the reason why the pig is such a sign of treif is the pig actually has split hooves, but it doesn't chew its cud. So the Gemara says a beautiful thing. The pig represents hypocrisy because the pig is actually kosher on the outside and treif on the inside. And that's much more repulsive than the horse, which is a nice, honest animal. You know, the horse is treif inside and out. You know what you get, no split hooves, etc. So the pig is a remez to the hypocrite that their heart is rebellious against Hashem, but they give the appearance of righteousness. So that's kind of why the pig is so repulsive. Now, there is a very strange Gemara, Medrash, that says, why is the pig called a chazir? Chazir means to go back, to return. Because liyasid lavo, in the days of Mashiach, it will go back to be a kosher animal. So we don't know exactly what process that's going to be, but the chazir will eventually be kosher. Now, it's interesting that they did discover around 25 years ago an animal called the babarusa, which is an African animal that resembles a pig, but it chews its cud. So people were very excited because they found a pig-like animal that chews its cud. So they thought maybe that's a kiyum of the messianic prophecy that the chazir is going to be kosher, liyasid lavo. So people thought that was a sign that maybe Mashiach was coming. Maybe it is a sign, you know, who knows? Just like the paradum, you know, they have a paradum in the United States now, a red heifer that they're raising. So I don't know, but in terms of your answer, I would say that you're not allowed to do it. By the way, I'll tell you a little story about jobs. There was a fellow in Vilna, an old mice in Vilna, about a person who was Mocher Svarim, like here. You know, he was selling Svarim outside of a base medrash for people to look at. And it turned out that some of the Svarim were little treatises from Haskalah, you know, modern books about leaving, learning, you know, different things like that. So a Rav saw these books and said to the person, he says, how can you sell these? I mean, you know, you're selling things that are martial people, you know, you have to stop selling it. So the person said, you know, Rebbe, he says, I'm very poor, this is my parnasa, people like these books, some of these books were written by rabbis of various ways. He says, how can you tell me to stop making a living? My family is going to starve. So the Rebbe tells him, okay, I promise you, you stop selling the books, I will get you a job. I will get you a good job. So the next day, the Rebbe says, I have a perfect job for you. So he takes him to a church across the street, and he climbs up to the belfry of the church where they ring the bell, and he says, you know, the church used to have this bell ringer that was working for 30 years, and he's an old man, he had to retire, so I got you the job, you get to ring the bell to the church every day, and it pays very well. So the Mocher Svarim is a frum Jew. He looks at the Rebbe and says, you know, Rebbe, what are you doing? You want me to ring a bell in a church? So the Rebbe said, what's the problem here? Many poskim say for Christians, Christianity is not a avodah zarah, so you're just summoning goyim to worship their religion. Some say that's okay. You think it's better to sell treif thoughts to Jews and be machshim take them up there? I'm telling you, if you need to choose between two jobs, it's better for you to ring the bell in the church. He says, you won't be hurting Klal Yisrael. He says, you need a job? Take this job instead. So the person understood the chaymer ha'inyan of not being machshil yidden without bikorsis and life. So I would say the same thing. You know, if you really need a job, we'll get you a job ringing a bell in a church somewhere instead of being megadol chazerim, which Chazal say is asra. Yeah. Yes. In fact, it's an amazing thing. The chazir is like such a meistic animal, and yet, as the Gemara in Tanya says, and it's absolutely confirmed by modern science, that there's a strong biological connection, and that's why swine flu diseases easily go from the pig to the human, even for heart transplants. When people experiment with animal hearts, you know, sounds strange, but you know, the chazir might be the source of the animal hearts that could be used for transplantation. I think part of the lesson there is that a person has to be margish the kayach of bechira, meaning to say, sometimes we think, oh, I'm a tzaddik, I'm immune from averus. So the idea that a chazir and an adam are so similar reminds us that we are capable of being on the highest madrega, and then we are capable of going all the way to the bottom. And we could be in the mud. And that's an important takara. This is what Pirkei Avos says, Al tamin bi'atzmecha ad yayin maysecha. Don't be overconfident. No matter how righteous we think we are, we can be nichshol, like in a moment. And maybe that's the reminder of the ketcher between the chazir and the person. Yeah.
Does the Torah ever mention about life on another planet?
Well, the Torah itself does not mention life on the other planet. And yet, on the other hand, if you look at the Rambam, you actually find that the Rambam describes planets and stars themselves, not only life on other planets, they are described as intelligent life, that there's some element of seichel within these planets, within these stars. They're a form of malochim and the like. So certainly it is yitachin that there are different types of life forms that could be forms of malochim. Malochim just means the shluchim that Hashem uses. I think where we would have a problem is this. I think we would have a problem because we're makir that Torah is the tachlis of the Bria. So we could believe there's all sorts of life all over the place, but we would have to believe that the tachlis that gives spiritual life to all of those worlds would have to be the Torah. So we would have a problem that if you found some intelligent life that is not connected to our Shemiras HaMitzvahs, and they're just doing their own thing, and they have their own society, and they have their own life, and it has nothing to do with the Shemiras HaMitzvahs that we do, I think we would have a problem accepting that as a possibility. But to say that things are there, you know, it is certainly Yitachin. They could be Nichlal and the Malachim. that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. I mean, if you look at any Sefer Kabbalah, or look at the Nefesh HaChayim, right? So we constantly say the mitzvahs that we do, the Torah that we learn, is mechayeh, it gives life to all of the olamos. So that implies there are these infinite worlds that get spiritual life. So, vice to chais, there's a lot out there besides planet Earth, which of course we know there's a lot out there, but there could be life and creatures there as well, but they would all be getting their chios from the Torah that we keep. Meaning, I think we would have difficulty in imagining a universe where some other world has some other Torah, that would be inconsistent with the idea that the Torah is mechayeh olamos. So we could accept the possibility of extraterrestrial life, but we would have to put it within a certain framework.
Yeah. I understand that the main mitzvah of the son of Chazan Rekala is to praise the Kala in front of the husband. If Reuben goes to Shimon's wedding and praises, tells Shimon, your Kala is beautiful, doesn't that kind of imply that Reuben is attracted to Shimon's wife?
Yeah. It's a very good question. I would say that to simply go over to him and say, oh, your wife is pretty, it would not be a tzenua dika thing. In fact, even the minhag that you see at many chasnas, that everybody sings Eishes Chayil, some people don't like that minhag so much. On the other hand, look at the original makor of the Mishnah. Kesad Meraktim, right? The Mishnah. Kesad Meraktim Mufnei HaKala, right? We sing it. How do we dance in front of the Kala? Right, so it's a machlokas. Beisham, he says, you got to be honest. Say what it is again. But Beisilov says, Kala Noya V'chasuda. So Noya V'chasuda is not physical beauty. Noya is beautiful and pious, but the beauty there is the beauty of spiritual beauty. And the way we do it is, we don't do it so much by talking about a specific person, because that's getting personal. But we sing it as a general praise that we're batuach. In other words, we want to give a chassan confidence. Well, let me explain this. Why is it so important to praise the Kala, etc.? Because you have to know that, you'll know this, a person is nervous when they get married. A person is nervous when they get married. A person wonders, am I ready for the achrayas of getting married? It's a big responsibility. Did I make the right decision? People are mesubic. What if I meet the perfect person the day after the chasna? you never know what's going to happen. And a person feels insecure. And we have to show that we're your chaverim, we're here to give you chizuk, we're here to tell you Hashem will help you, and we're here to tell you that we are batuach, that the Eibishter was mamtzi you, the proper zivuk for your life. So it's not so much that I have to know the Kala bipratiyos and talk about my individual knowledge of the Kala, but it's more like a statement that we have emuna in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he gave you someone that is right for you. That's really what we're talking about with that type of shvach. In fact, it's interesting, I wondered this myself, okay, Baruch Hashem and Eretz Yisrael chasnas are less expensive, but still expensive even here. But in America, chasnas go through the roof. I mean, if you want a bargain basement chasna, Lakewood offers a beautiful bargain basement package for chasna for B'nai Torah. It's, $10,000. That's bargain basement chasna in America. And a lot of times people have much more than that, even people who are not rich. So I always wondered to myself like this. I wondered, why do we make chasnas at all? I mean, all you need for a chasna is a minyan. And I could take $10,000, I could take $20,000. So I could make a chasna for $100. We'll have cake. Okay, let's see. Okay, we should wash. Okay. So we'll have, right, we'll have 10 people, I'll have his known, and the chasm can be one of them, so we'll have, and the parents, so we'll have, 7 guests, and tell the wives not to come, or whatever it is, or the caller can have her a few friends. We'll have a meal, we'll eat bread and a piece of chicken. So we can make the chasm for $50. And we don't need a band, so we'll dance a little bit. So, and then I could give the $10,000, the $20,000, they can keep them, give them parnasa for a year, maybe more than a year. So I was thinking to myself, why do we make chasnas at all? It doesn't make logical sense when you have B'nai Torah who need to live. So I thought about this. But then I read something from Rebbetzin Weinberg, Allah Shalom. She was the Rebbetzin of my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Weinberg. And she actually made this point. She said that because the chasna and kala are so worried, they're so scared, they don't know if they're ready, then having a big send-off is psychologically a chizuk that shows we're behind you, we're with you, you're not alone. And she said psychologically, okay, of course there are limits, you don't make a $500,000 wedding, whatever it is. But she said there is a concept of being marve shtickle in the simcha, because that gives them a foundation to know that they're not alone. And that struck me as a very, very interesting idea, that this is something a chassan and kala need. They need a certain amount of fanciness. Now, maybe each person is different, but they need something a little special to kind of put them in the frame. So, back to your answer, the praising of the kala is not so much referring to you getting personal about the kala, but it's you assuring the chassan that we are ma'minim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you someone that is special for you.
But didn't we discuss in a previous Q&A, or did the Rav say in a previous Q&A that Hashem could say, yeah, this girl is meant for this guy, and it doesn't happen in real life. They don't actually get married in real life.
Right. No, that's correct. So l'chol apachas, we're giving you a bracha, meaning to say, we're telling you, we are wishing you, we are blessing you, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you the shidduch that is hogun and roi for you. It doesn't have to come from first hand. I mean, after all, when we dance Kates and Meraktim with Mea Kala, Kala Noah v'chasuda, many of us don't know the Kala, right? How do I know Kala Noah v'chasuda? But the answer is, we want you to come in with that machshava. And of course, keep in mind, there's a word from the Gra. It's a very nice word. You know the Gemara in Brachas, they used to ask, in Eretz Yisrael, they used to ask when a person got married, did you get a matzah or a maitzah? Which woman did you get, a matzah or a matzah, or a maitzah? What's the pshat? Because there are two psukim. One pasuk says, matzah isha, matzah tov, you find a woman, you find goodness. Another is, motza ani marmi maves esa isha hara, the bad wife is worse than death, motza. So they would ask the guy at the chasna, matzah or motza? Now, that's a strange thing, the Gra says. What's the pshat? You ask a guy when he's getting married, did you get a good wife or did you get a wife that's more bitter than death? Hopefully, at least at the wedding, you know, that's going to be positive. So the Gra says that the pshat is like this. It's really a mussar to the person. Meaning we're telling the person, you know, you can have two types of marriages. You can have a marriage where the wife brings all of the goodness in the world, and you can have a marriage that's bitter. It's up to you in some ways. If you are the husband who treats his wife with derech eretz and kavod, then you'll get the good one. If you treat somebody with arrogance and with not caring, then you get the bad one. So the matzah is kind of a mussar to the person by telling the person, you decide what you're going to get. So in many, many ways, whether a marriage turns out to be good or not depends on the commitment that you have. Now, the same thing could be said to the woman, but basically the concept is this. If I am committed to make this good, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me the siyata d'shmaya to make it good. If I'm waiting to see what the other one will do for me, then I'm not going to be zeicha. You know, it's interesting, Rav Arush, the Breslover Rav down here. So he writes different books on Emuna and on Shalom Bayis. So he writes a book on Shalom Bayis only for men to read. So when I was in Flatbush a few months ago, I didn't realize this. He also wrote a book Shalom Bayis for women. So I was wondering if that was on. I wasn't supposed to read it, but whatever. I was curious. I was in a place that had the two books side by side. And I wanted to read, what is the difference between what he says, Shalom Bayis for men, and Shalom Bayis for women? So it's very interesting. I open up the Shalom Bayis for men. He says, you're a husband. You have 100% of the achrayas to make Shalom Bayis. Don't expect your wife to do anything. You must do everything. Okay. Then I picked up the Shalom Bayis for women. And he says to the woman, you have 100% of the responsibility for Shalom Bayis. Don't expect your husband to do anything. So what's the pshat? The pshat is, indeed, marriages are not 50-50. Marriages are 100-100, meaning to say, each person has to take the achrayas. I'm going to try to create Shalom Bayis. I will take that achrayas. Even if the other side is not responding to me properly, I will do the best I can. Now, if you think about it, if each side has internalized that hashgacha, then you're going to have shalom bayis, because no matter what happens, each side says, I'm going to be mishtadam to do my best. So that's what the Gra says. It's a Gevaldi Gevor. Matzah o matzah is not asking objectively, is your wife good or not? It's like saying to the guy, remember, you are at a precious drachim. You are at a fork of the road. You decide whether it'll be matzah isha, matzah tov, or maitza ani marmi mabas. That's a very, very important rule. People are often so concerned, did I get my basher? Did I get the right one? You know, only the Ribbono Shel Olam knows. But the emes is, whoever you get, you have the kayach to make it a blessed, holy relationship. And you have an achrayas to try to do that. Yeah.
So I wonder if the Rokh could tell us why it is that Bisman is able to use kosher maturis and not kosher maturis.
Okay, so this is a common issue you're going to confront on campuses. Again, ksav ashuris, which literally means Assyrian writing, is the special holy ksav, thank you, that we have for tefillin, mezuzos, and sefer Torah. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin states the very amazing idea that at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah was given in the old Hebrew script that is called Kesav Ivri. And if you want to know what that looks like, if you look in some dictionaries, you know, whenever they have the letter Aleph or letter Beis, they'll show you the old, it looks like a hieroglyphic type of thing. And we did not change over until Kesav Ashuris, till the time of the first destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and it was done by Ezra. Ezra was Mishana the Ksav from Kesav Ivri to Kesav Ashuris. So it seems very strange that we should be using Assyrian writing for our Sefer Torah. So the emes is, if you look at the Gemara, this is commonly misunderstood. When the Gemara says we got the writing in Assyria, which is really Babylonia, it doesn't mean it was a Babylonian script. Rather, we got it from the handwriting on the wall that when Hashem wanted to communicate a prophecy, it was done in Kesav Ashuris, which actually means that Kesav Ashuris is, to be more accurate, is not Babylonian writing. It is the divine writing that was revealed in Babylonia. And therefore, Ezra saw that as a sign from God that we should use it, because that's why it was revealed. Now, there is a tshuva from the Radvaz who says a very fascinating thing. He says, actually, Ksav Ashuris was the original Ksav on the first Luchos. The first Luchos were Ksav Ashuris. The first Luchos were smashed. And when we got the second Luchos, we were no longer on the Madrega to have that sacred writing. So it was substituted for an inferior level of writing. Many, many years later, HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepted the tshuva of Am Yisrael and gave us back Kesav Ashuris. So the 2 points I want to make is that Kesav Ashuris is not a foreign writing. It is a heavenly revealed writing in Babylonia. And second of all, it is the original writing of the Torah, which we lost as a result of the Chet HaEgel. So those are the 2 points about Kesav Ashuris to keep in mind. Now, what gave Ezra the authority? That's another question, because the halacha is a Navi cannot change a mitzvah. How could a Navi change a mitzvah? So the Gemara says, since the Torah is called Mishnah HaTorah, and Mishnah could be called repetition of the Torah, but it could also mean the changing Torah, Shinoi. Ezra saw in the drasha of Mishnah HaTorah that this is a Ksav Sheyachol Lehishtanos, that the Ksav can be changed. So the Torah itself said that the Ksav could be changed at a future date when Ksav Ashuris is revealed. Yes, it would be. A Sefer Torah, perhaps not, because, you know, it's interesting. A Sefer Torah, according to many opinions in Maseches Megillah, can actually be written in other languages. Did you see that? A Sefer Torah might be kosher in Greek. It might be kosher even in English. That would make it easy to be a Baal Korei, although you still have to know the trup. You know, in the beginning, God, you know, whatever, whatever it would be. So there is an opinion that Sefer Torah could be written in all languages. But tefillin and mezuzahs for sure cannot be, so they would be puzzle in Kesav Ivri.
I heard quoted in the name of Rav Dessler, all decisions are made by the heart. Isn't that kind of, isn't the Jews' way supposed to be sechel-based, first and foremost? And if we are going by the heart, all the decisions are made by the heart, and our sechel is merely justifying the decision we're about to make, then isn't that just pure definition of the honey, some worse free will and all that?
Well, yes, I'd have to see the particular quote. It could very well be that Rav Dessler is not telling you the way things should be. He might be describing the way things are for which we have to consciously work not to fall into that trap. In other words, I'd have to see the context. It could very well be he's warning us. In other words, he's not telling us how we should make decisions. He's warning us about how we do make decisions, and that's why Musar requires that we be aware of that. Meaning to say, it is often the case that we use our mind to justify our emotional desires and predilections. So Rav Dessler is warning us that that's why we have to try to be objective, right? I think that's what he means. So he's not telling you how you should live as a Jew. He's warning you that your mind, in at least your initial thinking, is not always an accurate guide to the truth, because we have so many factors emotionally that pull us away. An example that's given is, there's a phrase that the conscience of a person is like a compass of the heart, right? The compass directs you to the way you need to go, right? The compass always goes to the north. But if there's a magnetic field, that could throw the compass off. So a person's tivus is like a counter-magnetic field. So it may very well be that Hashem gave us a natural sense of what is emes and what is sheker. But that natural sense, which is like a moral compass, gets perverted by magnetic fields. And that's what Torah learning does. Torah learning is designed to try to purify our minds and our hearts, so that we try to make objectively correct decisions. So what you're saying is correct, and that's what Rav Dessler is really warning us about. That's why they say, B'shem Rav Chaim of Volozhin, that when you have a life decision to make and you just don't know what to do, you should learn uninterruptedly for 2 hours. Not about the decision. Don't learn anything. Learn something that has nothing to do with your question. And after 2 hours of uninterrupted learning, the first thought that you have, the feeling that you have, is a prophecy from Hashem, the way you should go. Because by purifying your mind and your heart, your conscience, your Yetzer Tov, will tell you what you should be doing. So you got to get rid of the static. You got to clear the static from your brain. You got to clear all of the other forces that are pulling you in different ways. So Rav Chaim says that the best way of clearing your mind, clearing your heart, getting rid of the junk, is by learning. And I would also add that it wouldn't hurt to say a capital of two of Tehillim also. And then you achieve a certain clarity. Yeah. In other words, Neser Sedibros? Yeah, so as everybody knows, when it says do not steal in the Neser Sedibros, Rashi brings from the Mechilta, so it is from the Mechilta, that lo signaiv means kidnapping. Don't kidnap a person. The prohibition against stealing money is another pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. So the way we learn this out is from one of the Yud Gimel Midos, right? Rabbi Yishmael tells us there are 13 principles by which the Torah is interpreted. And the 12th principle, right, right before the end, is Davor Halameid Me'inyano. What is the Midah of Davor Halameid Me'inyano? What does that mean? That when you have a phrase in a pasuk and you don't know what it means, you look at the context. You look at what comes before and what comes after, and then you figure out what it means in the middle, right? That's Dover Halameid Me'inyano. So Rashi makes the following argument, or the Mechilta makes the argument. What comes before Lo Signav? Lo Sirtzach, Lo Tinaf. Do not murder, do not commit adultery. Those are sins for which the Torah gives you a death penalty. So if Lo Tirtzach and Lo Tignov are death, Lo Tinaf are death penalty things, then lo tignov could not mean stealing money, because that's not a death penalty thing. So it has to be a sin for which we know you're chayav misa. That's how we know it's gonev nefashos. It's a straightforward application of davar halameit me'inyano. Now you may ask, well, wait a second. But the next one is, don't give false testimony. If you give false testimony, that's not a chiyuv misa. The answer is, in some cases it is. Edim, zomimim. If two edim say, Reuven killed Shimon and he's chayuv misa, and then we become zomimim, what does the Torah say? Get killed. So indeed, giving false testimony is not always a capital crime, but it sometimes is. So that's enough to fit it into that list. Okay, you want more questions? Yeah.
I was wondering if this is true, that the Chofetz Chaim, in his second marriage, after his first wife passed away, married someone who was much, much younger than himself, and he fathered a child at 70 years old.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I believe it is so, yeah.
I've heard
in fact, his daughter died relatively recently, within the past decade.
Okay, well.
Yeah.
I understand that the ways of pleasantness, part of that means that a man should not marry a woman of vastly different age than himself. So wasn't this violated here?
Well, you know, it could have. I'd have to go into more detail, meaning things that are connected to derech eretz and propriety are very situationally specific, meaning to say it could very well be that she was an orphaned woman. I want to check this, and I will check it. I mean, it's Hashem. There was no one else who would marry her. She had children from another marriage. In other words, it could very well be that she wouldn't be able to get married at all unless the Chofetz Chaim would take her in. And, of course, we also have to recognize that being married to the tzaddik of the generation might overcome a lot of other drawbacks as well. So sometimes when Chazal makes statements like that, and there is such a statement, don't marry somebody who's a very different age, this is in the nature of advice. It's not in the nature of halacha. And the advice, can be weighed against other factors. Again, maybe only a gadol can tell you that. When do I say it's an Eitz HaTova? When do I say it's a halacha? You know, we don't always know on our own. But there are things in Chazal that are not meant to apply in every circumstance, but they're simply factors that you put in. By the way, the question, of course, becomes, this is relevant to you guys, so don't marry somebody of a vastly different age. Well, what's a vastly different age? 5-year difference? 10-year difference? I know some shidduchim in which there's a 10-year difference, and you know, Baruch Hashem, they're doing okay, but you know, still, it's an issue to consider. Age is an issue. And of course, it also makes an issue of how old you are, meaning that, let's say, you know, if you're 20, you don't want to marry a 10-year-old, that's obvious, but just, you know, if you're 26 and you want to marry a 16-year-old, let's say it's Chassidus, that's very different than if you're 36 and you want to marry a 26, right? 10 years doesn't make a big difference in a 40 and a 30, but a 30 and a 20, you know, there is a difference. You know, so the difference in age, or the difference in years, depends on how significant it is, depends on the ages in question and the like. So, you know, it is a factor to consider. Okay, you have a good Shabbos.